from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Instagram had a name for it, Insta-famous. Users of the social media pic and video posting site who blew up became online famous, and many were teens. Same today with Tumblr, Snapchat, Vine, and more. Venues where savvy, funny, creative teens can become huge and do with a language and outlook and sometimes a payoff all their own. This hour on Point, inside the teenage world of social media. Later this hour, we'll look at the Free Kesha hashtag and the court case behind it. But first, joining me from New York is Elspeth Reeve, senior editor at The New Republic. She dove into the world of Tumblr fame and teen fortune and wrote about it in her piece headlined The Secret Lives of Tumblr Teens. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Elspeth, Ellie Reeve, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Caitlin Dewey joins me, digital cultural critic for The Washington Post. She writes the Intersect blog, looks at internet culture there. Caitlin Dewey, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Tumblr teens and their fortunes. It makes really fascinating reading, Ellie, and I want to get all into that. But Caitlin, would you just first for us just outline the sort of arsenal here of social media outlets that teens can now play in for fun and sometimes for fortune. Sort of paint the horizon for us. What's out there?
Well, it's very vast, as you suggest. Teens have been creators and celebrities and entrepreneurs on social media going back several years on YouTube, on Facebook to a lesser extent. And I think where we're really seeing them emerge from now are networks like Tumblr and Vine.
Facebook is pretty much passé at this point, but there are so many other options out there. Run us through how the most popular ones now are used in a way that, you know, non-teens may or may not be clued into.
Well, a lot of what we're seeing now is, well, I mean, there's actually quite a lot going on, but one of the things that seems to be quite a standout now is teens creating sort of one-off memes on something, a platform like Vine, or to a lesser extent, maybe we would say Twitter, also Tumblr, you know, or Instagram certainly as well, where these teens post a funny video and it goes massively viral. It seeps out into the mainstream internet where it confounds adults and people of my generation certainly as well. And then from there, these teens often manage to sort of convert that one-off moment into a larger career or a larger enterprise, which is really fascinating.
I mean, you get a sense of how this can work. This is off Twitter. Brands are always looking to jump on the latest viral hit. Here's the meme of the moment. A friend made a video montage of a California teenager, Daniel, walking in school hallways, the locker room, poolside, wearing some fashionable sneakers. Boom.
Damn, Daniel. Back at it again with the white van.
It's Vans and all kinds of brands are picking up on this one. Vans, the fashionable shoes, Clorox, Axe, even Denny's. Ellie, you're looking at Tumblr, but what do you hear in that? What is it? It's 12 seconds, but it's become a big deal.
I think you can hear in the voice what's so special about it. It's very charming. It's funny. It's strange. You can project into it whatever you want. It's been remixed into a song. There are kids who do dance routines to the song. And this all happened, like, over the weekend.
Every one of these different venues or social media outlets has a different kind of flavor to it. You look deeply at Tumblr, and you say it's kind of the place for the smart maybe a little oddball and not so unhappy about that, kids. What's happening there, Elspeth?
That's right. Unlike other social media networks, Tumblr really de-emphasizes your face. What you look like, what you dress like, your status symbols are not as important as the text and the jokes. And it's developed this culture where the posts that get the most amount of notes, the ones that circulate to millions of people, are about these like tiny moments of social humiliation that you experience as a teenager and it feels like totally crushing. Like one of my favorite jokes is, I just tried to say hi to someone and they didn't hear me. I'm never trying that again, right? Like, you remember what it was like as a teenager to, like, to have these moments that just feel absolutely crushing. And those are the things that really blow up on Tumblr. It's not being the most popular kid. It's about confessing your vulnerability.
And these don't just live as little notes wadded up in a classroom as they might have 20, 30 years ago. They can, as you say, become big. Tell us a little bit of the story of the Tumblr account Pizza and what happened with it.
That's right. I'd been following Pizza for years. I didn't even realize she was a teen at first. And she was very smart. She would reblog a lot of really good jokes, but she also had a really good strategy, which was anytime somebody mentioned pizza, like I love pizza, something like
which
that.
Which has to be a lot on Tumblr and social media.
Right, right. She would dig that up and reblog it to her millions of followers with a little comment on it. So one time someone
wrote— Did you say millions of followers?
Eventually she had a million followers,
okay.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Someone said, I wonder if pizza, Tumblr user pizza is Beyonce or God. And she commented, I'd like to confirm that I am both. And that just kicked it up further and it gets bigger and bigger. And these jokes will get like pulled back into your feed over and over. They're sort of disconnected from a moment that they just like have lives of their own.
So here's a teenager named Pizza. At one point in the story that you tell, she's like 15 years old. As you say, she goes to a million followers. And are they seeing everything that she puts up on Tumblr? Is that the way it works?
Yeah, but you have to realize she's not – when we think of teens on social media, we imagine it posting selfies a lot and stuff like that. That really wasn't her thing. It was mostly highlighting really good jokes, adding her own commentary to the jokes. The way Tumblr works is that you can append these little comments to these jokes and – it makes the joke even better, and then that recirculates bigger and bigger.
Some people turn that into cash. How's that work?
So there are two ways. You have your own Tumblr page that has its own distinct URL, and you can put banner ads on that page, just kind of like you would see on the New York Times. There's an ad on the right side for a bank or McDonald's or whatever. You can do that on Tumblr through Google AdSense. But that isn't how most people use Tumblr. They look at it just like you do in your Facebook feed, right? They look at that homepage that has everybody's comments in it. So these kids figured out a way to make basically native ads where they would endorse a product as if that was a sincere thought, that they really believed in this product with a link to it. And then that link would track what Tumblr sent that traffic to that page. And that was far more profitable. But Tumblr doesn't like that.
What happened to Pizza? She got banned eventually. Why? How?
That's right. A ring of kids created a platform where they were selling diet pills. They basically would write this fake testimonial that said, you know, my best friend recommended this organic supplement to me and I lost all this weight in 4 weeks. And that would kick to this diet pill page for raspberry ketones. And it had a video from Dr. Oz. And those kids were paid about $18 for every person who would buy one of those pills.
Wow.
So Tumblr doesn't like that. It's scammy. It's snake oil. It's, it's abusing the vulnerabilities of the core audience, which is teenage girls and who are insecure about their bodies. And so all these kids in this ring, which was a huge number, they had about a combined 30 million followers, were all terminated in August 2014.
Caitlin, how much of this, surely not everybody's an entrepreneur in this room. It's being used in all kinds of fascinating ways. And you can easily find the headlines, you know, about the 16-year-old turning an Instagram feed into a $15,000 a month social media empire and on and on. Is the money just at the edge of this? Is it a big piece of bait for teens engaging in this realm?
Yeah, that's definitely not a mainstream phenomenon. I mean, I suppose it's like anything else that the sort of cream of the crop rises that way, and those teens manage to make a career out of their social media presence, but it's actually quite difficult to do. And I think something that Elsbeth makes a really excellent point of in her story is that the teens who are doing this on Tumblr really represent the cutting edge of sort of digital strategy and savvy. That's not going to be the case for most teens. A lot has been written recently about teen celebrities on YouTube who are sort of having to drop out of that game or get side jobs or that sort of thing, because unless you're at the very top, it's hard to make a living off of that kind of work. But certainly it's something that a lot of teenagers are trying to do, whether or not they end up being successful.
And yet, Elspeth, Ellie, you write that it's not by accident. There, some of these teens are really focused on this and tremendously successful at becoming big-time marketers.
That's right. I spoke to two boys in particular who were very, very good, Jeremy Greenfield and Zach Lilly. They created a blog called So Relatable, and relatable is a term that kids use to talk about these jokes about, like, your daily life, you know, someone stepping on the back of your shoe. And they really approach this like a science and in figuring out how to build followers and grow an audience. And they showed me their bank records. And at one point, they were making $50,000 a month from Google.
Just from AdSense, from ads going up on their Tumblr offerings?
That's right. And they looked at how to tweak the layout of their blog because certain times of the year are more profitable for banner ads. They're little geniuses. And they're about when they were doing this, they were 18, 19 years old.
This is fascinating. I mean, we thought that this was all figured out in the age of Mad Men and Madison Avenue. But we may be reading you, Ellie. We may be breeding a new generation where the nuance of marketing is just mind-boggling.
Yes, and something that made them so good at it was that Tumblr really teaches you to be very sensitive to what other people are thinking, and that emotional intelligence helped them be better marketers.
Shawn Mendes became Vine famous. Vine with a little loops of video. He turned that fame into a record deal. You hear some of his singles now on Top 40 Radio. Here's one of his Vines from 2014.
Take a piece of my heart and make it alone.
Every social media outlet has different kinds of rules or what recipes for success. Here's Tumblr user Leviosa, who also created a YouTube channel. She made a video on how to become Tumblr famous. There are lots of these videos on YouTube. Leviosa says step one, be a girl. Step two, take lots of selfies. And
step three is do not show your face. That's right, people. In order to become Tumblr famous and have a Tumblr famous photo, you can't show your face. So really, it doesn't matter what this looks like at all. All the good photos on Tumblr, nobody's showing their faces. The girls, nope, they have no faces. We have no idea who they are. We don't know what they look like.
Though on others, Instagram, for example, sure, people are going to know who you are. Here's Sean Magira, became a celebrity on Instagram, had a sponsorship deal with a clothing line, was the subject of a short documentary, Insta Fame.
I went in line to get a drink of water with my friend, and she taps me on the back. She's like, turn around. I turn around, there's like a line of 50 people just waiting to take a picture. It was ridiculous. Am I famous, or is it just like, what? I don't know what's going on.
Ellie Reeve, one of the things about Tumblr that makes it so interesting is that you are, as you say, anonymous or can be there. And so you've got teens just making up a persona for whatever their goal is. It doesn't need to have anything to do with their personal public face.
That's right. Pizza sort of embodied the spirit of pizza, this like approachable, friendly food. She didn't write very much about herself. And likewise, the boys I talked to, they adamantly told me they did not have personal brands. One of them doesn't even have a Facebook account.
In other words, their honest face, their true self, they don't want that up there. They're, what, making up a character?
For them, it was all about the content. They were adamant that they would never sacrifice the integrity of their content for their personal brand, to promote their face, to get likes on a photograph.
What does that mean exactly? It's about the content, not their personal brand.
It's about the jokes, about the observations, about life, about the way people interact, about heartbreak, and a lot less about, like, me for who I am, make me feel good.
That is interesting, Caitlin. So there's a clear understanding among teens that you might go after this for fame and fortune, but there's other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what I think another sort of interesting point here is that there's sort of these dual and competing motivations behind what teens sort of try to achieve when they're going after internet fame. So on one hand, it's extremely important that they look authentic. They need to portray that this sort of very thorough and, authentic nature. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's extremely performative, as all social media is. People are essentially always performing characters. They're not performing themselves, but they have to make it appear as though they are.
What does that mean for teen life these days? I mean, I guess that's always been the case, right? You look back at the movies from the 1950s and 60s, and of course people are thinking about how they present in public, and they may chat in private about how that's different from who I really am. Does that get cranked up to another level in this age, Caitlin?
I don't think so. I think it's just more observable now. It's more documented, teenagers and adults as well. I mean, this is by no means a teen phenomenon, have always struggled to negotiate between their performed and quote-unquote authentic selves, whether or not that's even a ideal that exists. But now, because of platforms like Tumblr, where we can see sort of various shades and different types of performances that teenagers give for different audiences, we have a clearer vision of sort of how this works for teenagers, which is really pretty incredible.
Ellie, did you come out of this seeing self-expression, self-realization, or very elaborate posing?
Oh, well, the reason that I was drawn to the kids that I wrote about was that I thought it was about self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
It was very disconnected from who they were. And some kids told me that they went to Tumblr because it was a break from their local friends, that they could confess what they were worried about, what they cared about, what they were afraid of, without fear of retribution from their friend circle. They could talk about a crush without their best friend making fun of them for it.
Mm-hmm. And so there it is. Chris is calling from New Orleans. Lots of callers on this subject. It's interesting. Chris, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I have a close personal friend who about 8 or 9 years ago started a Tumblr account that was basically just a collection of his thoughts on life, on literature, philosophy, technology. It ended up becoming very popular with, I believe, hundreds of thousands of followers. And actually, through this account, he was approached by a number of technology companies and ultimately approached by Facebook, and now has a senior position at Facebook. That all came about because of his Tumblr account.
And what was his persona in the Tumblr account, or what was he offering, Chris?
He basically was a collection of his writings on all sorts of subjects, from life, technology, philosophy, literature. It was just sort of a collection of his thoughts and views on all aspects of life.
He must have been older than a teenager at that time, or not?
He was about 24 at the time. But he's a unique person. I mean, he's a very smart, charismatic person who writes very well. And so he was young 20s at the time that he began this.
Wow. And now he's at Facebook. Caitlin, what do you make of that story? Is this the new path to, career success? As this generation moves out of its teens, be discovered by your voice in social media?
It's certainly a path. I mean, I think if you look at the messaging that's being given to teenagers by, people like guidance counselors and career counselors now, there used to be this message that you shouldn't have any social media presence, that whatever you post could come back to haunt you. I think a lot of teenagers and college students are being told now that there's actually this sort of alternate route, that if you develop a presence on social media, that could be your path to a job. At the same time, I think Chris's friend is obviously very gifted, maybe a special case. I don't know how many people Facebook has hired off of their Tumblr blogs.
Or whether that's the goal for many, but people do blow up like that. 19-year-old Carter Reynolds was a big Vine celebrity. Again, the little video loops so big that Coke paid him to endorse their product during their Share a Coke campaign. He did, in a Vine that's had over 9 million loops.
Mom, are you drinking my Coke?
What do you mean?
It has my name on it.
Oh.
It's all good, though. You can have it.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, there you go. Off to stardom. Ed in Folks Run, Virginia. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi. My nephew, many years ago, when he was still in grade school, he got into those computer things, and everyone thought he wouldn't turn out to be much of anything. Well, he sat in front of those computers, and now he's making over $1 million a year.
Doing what, Ed?
Just writing these video games and things for There's a lot of people. He sells a lot of things at Walmart, and it's just because of the internet, just because he does went through this internet thing.
Is he a musician or a comedian or a or what's
he's,
his?
He's a comedian. He's a comedian. It's at TobyTurner.com. They call him Tobuscus, and he writes a lot of stories. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of him because he has merchandise everywhere now.
Wow.
But, yeah, it's a very profitable business.
The kid you were all worried about, Ellie, Caitlin, what do you make of the story?
Well, the internet is this really wonderful place where you can find an audience no matter where you come from. You know, you really can build a career based on the strength of what you have to say if you figure out how to spread your message around.
And sometimes it's career and money oriented, and sometimes it's not. Caitlin, take us into some of how these others are being used these days. I was chatting with a teenage friend the other day about Instagram, and apparently the thing is that you've got your sort of public Instagram account where you shape a public image, and then what her crowd was calling your Finstagram account, which your parents may not know about, which isn't your face to the world, but where you can put up stuff that's funny or off color or more private, and just your friends are in there. Sort of talk about a layered use of social media, even more than one account and expression in the same vein.
Yeah, so what you're describing is a really fascinating phenomenon. It's a reaction to what sociologists call context collapse, which is this idea that, you know, people usually tailor their personalities to speak to specific types of audiences. You know, I'm talking to you differently on the radio than I might talk to my mother or a friend. Mm-hmm. But the problem with social media is that it sort of squishes all those different audiences together. It makes it really difficult for all people, but maybe especially someone like a teenager who has to negotiate parental relationships and that kind of thing. And it makes it difficult for them to express themselves. So on Instagram, as well as a number of other networks, I mean, I think this is partially behind the rise of anonymous apps like Yik Yak and After School and that sort of thing, teenagers are creating multiple accounts, one where they can address a more public audience, one where they can address an audience, you know, where maybe it's more appropriate to say things that are off color and make jokes and that sort of thing. So it's really a very smart strategy that they've developed to deal with this problem.
I wonder, Ellie, if you ended up feeling as though this was liberating for teen users or a kind of, I don't know, further requirement, time suck, even a kind of tyranny, because, of course, lots of norms can be expressed in social media as well, sometimes maybe even, I don't know, confining.
I have read a lot about that. Instagram in particular is very high stress. You want to get a lot of likes on all of your selfies. If someone doesn't comment on your selfie, then you're upset. Maybe there's a problem in your friendship. But the Tumblr kids, this did seem to be liberating. Maybe you're not popular at school, but you're popular on the internet.
Let's go to Owen in Atlanta, Georgia. Owen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to add, I feel like there's somewhat of a problem with Tumblr because, as I think it is important for teens to have a voice, it seems that certain ideas just get pushed in front of every teen's face to where some of these teens don't have a voice. They're just following the voice that has the most notes. So a lot of these ideas, I feel like, are completely valid, but they're the only thing that matters to these teens on Tumblr. And I just wanted to see what you guys think of this, of like, it even has to go with this diet pill scheme you're talking about. Now I see a lot of survey schemes. And then even with some of these social justice issues, the only idea that gets a lot of notes is the only idea that matters. I just wanted to see what you guys thought about that.
Caitlin, let me put it first to you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there's a impulse to see the internet as sort of fundamentally changing these dynamics that actually existed previously. So teenagers and, you know, people generally always receive a lot of very powerful social messaging about the sorts of things they should believe or not believe. At the same time, there's a lot of cross-current information. That's the case on Tumblr, too. You know, Tumblr does have a very large social justice community, for instance. There are certainly some political or social beliefs that have a lot of support on Tumblr. But at the same time, it's a massive community. You can really find anything there that you want. And because it's not algorithmically filtered, it's quite easy to choose what sources of information you subscribe to.
We're talking about teenage social media influencers, sometimes superstars. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ellie Vicarosa writes to us, says, my daughter doesn't make a move without consulting the teenage superstars of social media. The clothes she chooses, the car she wants, the makeup she applies to her pretty little face are all dictated by these 16-year-old influencers. It sounds there like a mother worried that her daughter, you know, is losing some personal agency here.
Well, I think that's a phenomenon that's always been present, though.
Yeah,
maybe it's not
yeah.
coming from Hollywood or whatever, or TV or teen magazines. Now it's coming from peers. So it's always been like that. It's just the influencers have changed.
And does it put a different crew in charge? I mean, you say on Tumblr that it's sort of the kids who might have been marginal at one time. Now they've got a venue. Is there an empowerment that they feel along with that?
Yes, I think so. And that's tied up a little bit with what the previous caller was talking about with social justice. Maybe in school cafeterias, sometimes those are still segregated, right? Like the black kids that sit at one table, the white kids at a different table. But mm-hmm. on social media, it's all mixed. The white kids reblogged black kids' vines and vice versa. And I think it has really changed the culture. They're far more empathetic to people who are different from them.
Do you think, Caitlin, that we're shaping a different American psychological profile over, I don't know, 10 or 20 years here as the venue of interaction changes like this?
Well, that's certainly the great hope of the internet, right? That it will lead to this sort of utopia where there's a free exchange of ideas and, you know, greater understanding and things of that nature. I think certain Tumblr communities do bear that out. I think it gives us a lot of hope that that will be the case. But I think if you're looking at the internet more generally, it's quite clear that there are other pressures and powers and hierarchies in place that will maybe keep things a little less idyllic than they might be in certain Tumblr communities, for instance.
Would you have rather grown up with this social media ubiquity that we see now, Caitlin, or, 10, 15 years ago before it got quite so widespread?
You know what? I did grow up with a certain amount of social media ubiquity. I predate Tumblr by a bit. Sort of platform of choice in my day was LiveJournal, mm-hmm. rest in peace. But you know what? As a teenager, that was profoundly important to me and to my sense of self and to my sense of expression. And I'm extremely understanding and sympathetic to the way teens are trying to work out those issues now. I certainly feel that given the amount of attention that's now paid to teen social media practices by the media and the like, they are under a greater degree of scrutiny, and I do not envy them there. But aside from that, they're working in a really amazing creative environment.
And we read from both of you just how much is bubbling there. It's really, really interesting.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
Caitlin's in Washington, Elspeth is in New York, and Min Vu is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Min Vu, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. What's up, man?
We're just learning here, Min. What do you think?
I think, like, social media is great, especially the kids with really big followings, because it's really an opportunity to just be yourself, and a lot of other kids kind of get inspiration from that, too.
What makes people popular in social media, by your lights, Min?
For me, it's just about people being really passionate about the things that they're into. I follow some people that are really into Japanese subculture, and they'll spend outrageous amounts of money on, like, makeup and wigs. But they'll be posting selfies every day, and, like, it's a little bit of a chore to look like that every day, but there are a lot of people all over the world that are into that, and they kind of want to be like that too, but sometimes they can't. They don't have the money. Their parents won't let them. But it just kind of allows a certain new global lifestyle to kind of to flourish.
Do you feel like out of sitting in Omaha, you can be part of something that's really global?
Yes, absolutely. I'm on Instagram all the time, and I have a small following, but I interact with people from like the Netherlands, Germany, just people all over the world with common interests. And it's a really cool globalization happening right in front of us today.
Min, that sounds great. How old are you, if I may ask?
I'm 21 years old, and I'm loving the digital age.
Enjoy it, Min. I'm really glad for your call. I mean, Ellie, there's the liberation path right there. Not just that, but sort of, you know, belong to whatever interesting subset you want out of Japan or you name it.
That's right. Someone at Tumblr told me something really interesting, which I think frames it well, which is it's the smart, weird kid at one school connecting with all the smart, weird kids from all over the world. So Pizza, she's from Australia, but she's got fans in California, and they're able to talk to each other about all different kinds of things. You know, there's been a lot of talk about why kids like Bernie Sanders, who wants free college tuition. Mm-hmm. Well, kids on Tumblr know that in other countries, college doesn't cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so they're more educated because they have this global community to talk to.
Jansen in Nashville, Tennessee. Jansen, you're on.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Pretty good. What do you know?
I was wanting to introduce what originally started as an offshoot of Tumblr but moved to Twitter, this group called the Illuminati that I always thought was fascinating. I was a member early on, but it was all a lot of anonymous accounts that had hundreds of thousands of followers where people would develop a persona and write these 140-character poems. But then a lot of them moved into this elite status where they published their poetry anonymously and would just sell it over Kickstarter or Amazon and make hundreds or even thousands of dollars just based on the followers they got without ever using pictures of themselves or their name. And I always thought that was an interesting community to start up, and a lot of times they were dealing with things, you know, pretty heavy for 16, 17-year-olds. A lot of it dealt with relationships, sex, depression, self-harm, a lot of heavy topics, but they were all I was impressed by how they were broached in this community.
Why do you think they migrated from Tumblr into Twitter and the anonymous Twitter in particular, Jensen?
It was always sort of weird to me. It started with a single guy who operated under the pseudonym Santiago, and I think it's the immediacy of Twitter that Tumblr has to some extent as you scroll through a feed, but Twitter, you know, that's always been its most competitive point. That you can just constantly scroll through and see all of this short-form writing that's easily digestible. But a lot of these people were posting hundreds of short poems a day. Just the sort of prolific rate of output was crazy.
Jensen, that is yet another fascinating angle on this. I mean, Caitlin, there's so many facets of what's going to pop up here. That doesn't sound much like marketing. Some went on to sell their poems, but that's different than selling Coca-Cola, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm absolutely going to check out that Twitter feed / Tumblr as well because it sounds remarkable. I mean, we are seeing amazing creative forms emerge out of social media. Some come from teens, some come from, you know, older artists. But there are entire literary forms that are being born out of social media. You know, there is this sort of new type of performance art that revolves around programming bots that tweet or that post things to Tumblr. This is just another example of some of the sort of amazing creative projects that are coming out of this space.
Ellie, we're hearing about freedom and awareness and some creativity here, but we've also got some concerned response online. Toyota says, from what I've heard so far, I don't like it. Reading here, mixing ads with your public thoughts or doing sensational stuff just to get ad hits seems so disingenuous to me. It's like making friends to sell them Amway products. It just feels slimy. What do you say, Ellie?
Well, the diet pill ads were very controversial. If you search for these people's names in Tumblr, people are very angry that they tried to sell diet pills to teenage girls, basically, that they tried to exploit this idea of relatable and turn that into an ad. And even the kids today, the ones who are banned, they regret what they did. But it's very difficult to make money off the written word.
So on balance, how did you come out of this thinking about what the influence is going to be? We're going to be marketed to with greater subtlety than ever in history, or we're going to have self-realized people with more avenues of expression than ever in history, or you tell us, Ellie.
Well, I think it's both. I think you can see online that with the ability to talk to so many people from around the world, they've developed a very sophisticated sense of humor. And I love that. It's like really funny. Like, I can't believe how funny they are and how insightful they are. But on the other hand, yes, it means that the marketer, that we will be deluged with ads that pick at our heartstrings, you know, that'll make us cry way more than like a drug commercial ad.
I have to really agree on the humor. It seems to get past some of the kind of big steamroller humor of the past. The nuance can be way out there, and yet you recognize it right away when it's true and hits home. I look forward to reading a lot more from some of the people who are honing that openness, that insight in social media right now as teenagers. Ellie Reeves, Elspeth Reeves, really enjoyed your piece in The New Republic, The Secret Lives of Tumblr Teens. Listeners, you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Ellie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Caitlin Dewey, digital culture critic at The Washington Post, reader blog The Intersect. Caitlin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, the story behind the hashtag Free Kesha moment. This is On Point. On Friday, a New York judge denied pop star Kesha's request to get out of her contract with music producer Dr. Luke. She claims he sexually abused her. Many musicians and fans are rallying behind Kesha in the wake of the court's decision. Joining me now with more on this from New York is Eric Gardner, senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter, covers business and law. He's been watching the court battle between Kesha and Dr. Luke from the beginning. Eric Gardner, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So we've just heard about this $250,000, gift, I guess, for Kesha to help cover her living expenses from another pop star. Tell us who and why.
Well, at the moment, she's not getting any royalties because she's in this contract dispute. The cost of litigation is very expensive, so she needs funds to continue her campaign, her attempt to escape Dr. Luke and the contract that she's made.
And Taylor Swift stepped in with his $250,000. That's a pretty significant stepping up. What was the court that this was in on Friday, and what exactly was being claimed? What did the judge say?
This was a New York State court. Kesha was looking for an injunction so that she could escape the contract, that she could record outside of Dr. Luke's purview. And the judge weighed the arguments, weighed whether she had a likelihood of success in her claims and whether or not she would suffer harm if an injunction didn't issue, and ultimately decided that at this point she couldn't make the argument. So it was a big legal loss for Kesha, but she was able to rally a lot of supporters who are really blaming Dr. Luke and Sony for what's happened.
Judge Shirley Kornreich said, "You're asking the court to decimate a contract that was heavily negotiated and typical for the industry," and said no injunction. The case can go forward, but that may be a long, long road. There were fans outside that courthouse on Friday chanting their support.
Free Kesha now! Free Kesha now! Free Kesha now!
Eric Gardner, what does Kesha allege happened here?
She alleges that Dr. Luke has abused her many ways. She alleges about a decade ago she was given drugs and raped, and that the verbal abuse continued thereafter to the extent that you know she became bulimic. She entered rehab and she suffered all sorts of pains from this. She says that this is basically discrimination, human rights abuse, and that a contract can't stand up to this circumstance.
She's supposed to deliver 6 more albums under this contract, Dr. Luke, I guess, and Sony. He's a big deal. I mean, he's worked with a lot of artists, Kelly Clarkson on her Since You've Been Gone, Katy Perry on I Kissed a Girl, Miley Cyrus on Party in the USA, Pink's Who Knew. On the other hand, you look at what Kesha's claiming, and it sounds like a nightmare to be under a guy, if these allegations are true, with that kind of record with her.
Yes, this case is very public and has the potential of sending a powerful message. The question is, what message? To many, the particulars of Kesha's contractual obligations don't matter. Here's a woman claiming rape. They say she should be able to escape her alleged abuser. On the other hand, Sony and Dr. Luke worry that if Kesha is able to get out of the contract simply by talking about a decade-old unsubstantiated abuse, that's a dangerous precedent to set. It could allow other artists an escape hatch from their obligations.
She was 17, I guess, when she moved from Nashville to Los Angeles, went to work with Dr. Luke. He runs Kimo Sabe Records, and she became pretty big pretty quickly. Do people, he's been a hit maker. Do they give him credit for that?
Yeah, she the abuse happened and then she continued to record with him and they had a very successful time. That album TikTok was a best seller. They certainly did, interesting things in the music realm together. But at some point, the relationship became strained. She wanted out and, it's his contention that this all amounts to some sort of extortion attempt on her part, where if he didn't let her out, she was going to claim abuse, and basically that's happened. And now a court has to look at the dueling claims from both sides and figure out how to move forward.
Dr. Luke and Sony, I guess, say that she's free to work with another producer on upcoming albums to fulfill that contract. She says, after all this bad blood, whatever I do, you'll bury it, and that she's held hostage by Sony and Dr. Luke here.
Yeah, Sony, this is a tough one for Sony because they want to make a line drawn. They also don't like the bad attention that this case has drawn to them. So, what they have tried to do is it's make certain accommodations where they say, you can still record for us, for Sony. Dr. Luke won't have any part of it. She doesn't believe that the offer is enough. She thinks that she's still under a contractual control from her abuser, and that this can't stand. The problem is, at this point, the judge just doesn't see enough backing her claims to give her this relief, which in the judge's mind is rather extraordinary and rips up a contract.
Kesha is 28 years old now. She and her attorneys say, look, a pop star career doesn't last forever. The clock is, speaking of TikTok, the clock is ticking here. Who wins? Who loses in this standoff? I guess the first round, you have to say she just lost.
At this point, we have to say everyone has lost. No one's coming out of this particularly well. Dr. Luke won the day on Friday, at least in court. But, Free Kesha has been trending worldwide. There are lots of people who don't think very nicely of him right now. I think he's going to have trouble working with other artists, especially female ones at this point. So we can hardly say that he's a winner too. Sony is, you know, also has this PR nightmare in front of them, and Kesha, meanwhile, you know, can't really work. So at this point, it looks like a lose-lose situation for all.
Taylor Swift kicking in $250,000 for Kesha's legal expenses, but no big winners here. Eric Gardner, senior editor at The Hollywood Reporter, joining us today from New York. Thanks so much, Eric, for being with us for a minute.
Absolutely.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.